Welcome to Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Joining me today is the opinion editor at antiwar.com and my colleague at the Libertarian Institute, Kyle Anzalone. Kyle, where is the best place for people to find your show?
The Libertarian Institute. Right, with your show, it's hosted there. So Conflicts of Interest, myself, Connor Freeman, Will Porter. And then be sure to check out the new stuff that me and Will are doing at the Libertarian Institute. News stories with a libertarian take every day. Although, you know, we want to do more like domestic stuff, but we start doing it last week and Russia invaded Ukraine. So it's been pretty much just foreign policy coverage. But that's the big news of the day.
Please explain to me in as deep detail as possible so we can get a real understanding of the situation. What is the Revolution of Dignity, the 2014 coup in Ukraine?
Yeah, so it's got a bunch of names, the Revolution of Dignity. I think it's probably going to be most known by our audiences as the Euromaidan or the 2014 Ukraine coup. It actually starts in late 2013 in November, and it starts of protest against the president, Viktor Yanukovych. And there's various reasons for the protests. A lot of it is corruption, and rightfully so. It's a very corrupt government. Ukraine has a very corrupt system. They make billions of dollars a year. It's just, you know, with Russian gas flowing through their country and things like that. Of course, like Russia, after the Soviet Union's dissolved, you have an entire country where nobody owns anything and all this stuff. And so it ends up getting handed out fairly corruptly. And Anne, I forget her last name, just did a really good interview with Scott Horton on this. I'll try to look it up when you're talking at some point and give her full name, on how corrupt it was in Russia. And, you know, this is all very important because 30 years ago, if you have like all of the industry in the country up for grabs and it's going to the most corrupt people, well, then this is going to have some pretty serious consequences for that country, probably forever, but definitely, you know, for the decades that preceded it. And so, you know, leading up to 2014, that's one of the things. And, you know, all the different leaders of Ukraine had been corrupt. There had been different revolutions there before, including in 2004 when the U.S. carried out the Orange Revolution and overthrew the same guy, actually. And so protests break out in late November with people, I think a lot of student movements, gathering in what they call like Freedom Square, Independence Square, or whatever, in the capital of Ukraine, Kiev. And those protesters are, you know, met with police, and there's some clashes and things like that. I think people die pretty early on, but not like in huge numbers or anything like that. The protests go on for quite a bit, and the U.S. starts to get very involved in the protests. And so, you know, it's one of those things where maybe the U.S. was involved in facilitating even the creation of the protests. Maybe it was more the case of the U.S. was, saw a protest movement in Ukraine and then just really exacerbated what was going on there, right? But either way, U.S. senators get involved. John McCain, Chris Murphy are on the ground. Victoria Nuland, who is, I think, the U.S. like envoy to NATO or to Eastern Europe or something like that. She's an Obama administration official, is on the ground there handing out cookies. Jake Sullivan, who's the current national security advisor, is involved. Jeffrey Pyatt's another U.S. Eastern European official who's involved in all this. And importantly, then Vice President Joe Biden is like kind of overseeing this for the White House. And so, you know how earlier in the Biden administration, Kamala Harris was like in charge of the immigration policy? That's what's going on here, where Joe Biden's in charge of, you know, loosely, right? Like Obama's still the president and, you know, and everything. But, you know, he is really, I think, like giving like the White House level permission for what's going on and what the U.S. is doing in Ukraine. And so during this time, Ukraine is negotiating two different trade deals, one with Russia and one with the EU or, you know, the Western countries. And there's various reporting on this, but I mean, Russia offered a pretty solid deal to Ukraine, and the European deal said that they couldn't accept the Russian deal. And so because of that, they end up taking the Russian agreement. And so, you know, they reject the European agreement and end up taking the Russian agreement. And this really exacerbates the protests. And, you know, this seems like the kind of thing that suggests that the U.S. is a very large hand behind it, because, you know, one of the reasons that the Ukrainian government didn't take the European deal was because of the austerity measures imposed and things like that. And, you know, as a libertarian, I don't think there should be government spending, but if you are a Ukrainian citizen and your government, you know, makes tons of money, you know, kind of on contracts negotiated on behalf of you, and then your government is just stealing all that money, and when they need more money, they are going to like cut welfare benefits rather than cutting like government corruption. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it's very complicated. It's not as simple as saying like the libertarian position here is that austerity good for Ukraine and, you know, Russian loan package is bad, because it's a lot more complicated than that. And so, however you want to look at it, the offer from Russia, at least, you know, in the immediate term, was definitely a better offer. And during this time, there was a negotiated deal for new elections to be held in Ukraine prior to whenever they were scheduled. But that was pushed up. And by the end of February, they had removed the Ukrainian government from power. It fled. And then, of course, one of the most important and famous parts of all of this is, or infamous, Victoria Nuland's call to Jeffrey Pyatt. You know, look it up, the F the EU call, where she's talking about who's going to go into the new government. And she's talking about Yats being the guy. I think that it's actually pronounced like Yats, and you know, Yats would be short. And then you have Klitschko, the botser, who's now the current mayor of Kiev. You know, he's getting a lot of attention and play now because of that role. You know, they got him in fatigues holding like a big ass gun. You know, on the media running now. So they want him outside of the government, you know, not in the government, and that's what ends up happening. And then they put they also designated the position of this guy, Tonnybrook, who was one of the main people involved in some of the right wing, like ultra-nationalist, you know, borderline neo-Nazi parties in Ukraine, including the Svoboda Party. And so, you know, we could get more into that in a minute, but, you know, that is kind of, you know, somebody that the U.S. is promoting here that has a very ugly background. Man, so yeah, that, I mean, that's how the government gets overthrown. The U.S. is behind it. Of course, that, you know, causes a civil war to break out, Russia to annex the Crimean Peninsula. The U.S. responds with sanctions on Russia, arming the Ukrainians in their civil war against the Russian-backed separatists in the Donbass. And a lot of that civil war is provoked because of some of like the ultra-nationalist elements in Ukraine carried out a couple pretty vicious attacks on buildings with ethnic Russians in there, like burning people alive, terrible things like that. So, yeah, you asked me more detail, whatever I skipped over too much. It's been a while. I was, I had to go back and refresh myself a little bit, because this is 8 years ago now. And that is an important thing to remember in all this. You know, people are just now pretending that there's a war in Ukraine. For the Donbass region of Ukraine and eastern Ukraine in general, there has been a war ongoing there for 8 years.
So Putin said in his February 24th address, "On February 22nd, I made a decision to carry out a special military operation. The purpose of this operation is to protect people who, for 8 years now, have been facing humiliation and genocide perpetrated by the Kiev regime. To this end, we will seek to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine." What is it with calling the current Ukrainian regime a bunch of Nazis? Is that just sort of like in America, where everyone who is to the right of Mao is a Nazi? Or are we actually dealing with a National Socialist regime?
So, yeah, I mean, there's some truth to it. But also, I think when, you know, Putin is talking about denazifying, you know, the government, that could mean quite a bit more than just like taking out the legitimate neo-Nazis that are in Ukraine. And so I don't want to just, you know, endorse it, because that could be a euphemism that Putin is using essentially for cleansing the government of anybody who doesn't follow the Russian line. But there is the Azov Battalion in Ukraine. And just yesterday, me and Will Porter wrote up a story on this for the Libertarian Institute. You can find it on the blog there. And the Azov Battalion is a part of the Ukrainian National Guard. And this is a tweet from the Ukrainian National Guard, verified Twitter account. It now has a warning on it, but for the first 12 hours, it didn't. But the tweet is about, says in English in the tweet, that they are dipping bullets in pig's lard to shoot at the Muslim orcs that are fighting for Russia, right? And so just, you know, as a current example of what the Azov Battalion is, like, that's, you know, that's the level that we're talking about here. Like, that's disgusting. And to put it out on the Twitter account like that, like, you know, I mean, they're telling you who they are. And so, you know, the Azov Battalion guys have this patch that you'll see often. It's like a Z with a lion through it. It's the Wolfsongle. It's a Nazi era patch. You know, it dates back to that. In Mine and Will's article, actually, there's also a like Vlad Sun that's also like a ethno-nationalist like logo. And these people are like descendants of the movement founded by Stefan Bandera, who was a World War II Ukrainian collaborator with the Nazis when they moved into Ukraine. And so, you know, he had his own militias that carried out ethnic pogroms and things like that. You know, when people hear Nazi, you know, the immediate thought is anti-Jew. I think these people are more neo-Nazis in the sense of like Ukrainian Aryan supremacy. You heard somebody on the BBC saying how terrible it was that blonde-haired, blue-eyed people were killing each other, right? You know, that's what's bad about this to them. Yeah, and I'm not saying that, you know, they like Jews or anything like that. I'm just saying that, you know, I don't think what they've done in Ukraine is go around and, like, kill Jews. And like, that's the kind of Nazis that they are. I think, you know, they're, like, they believe in, you know, violent ethnic supremacy of ethnic Ukrainians who are probably mostly Aryans of Ukraine, right? that's the ideology there. And so, yeah, they're descendants of Bandera. In 2010, the Ukrainian government like made Stefan Bandera an official hero of Ukraine. The move was denounced by the European Union Congress and Israel, and I think even the Polish government, because, you know, this is a pretty ugly figure who carried out attacks against ethnic Poles as well. It's not just Russians or things like that these people don't like. You know, there are other minorities in Ukraine other than the Russians. And so, and in fact, that's a good point to make. After the post-2014 coup, is one of the first things the government tried to do is ban the Russian language and things like that, eliminate it from the government. And, you know, make Ukraine the official language, which was, you know, mainly, I think, saw as a target against the Russians. But there's also Hungarians and Poles in Ukraine who obviously took offense to this kind of action, you know, targeting their language and their heritage and things like that. David Stockman has a pretty good article, new article out at antiwar.com. Titled "We Are Not Useful Idiots," and he goes through kind of how Ukraine was collaborated together as a state, and you'll see that because there's not great borders here, and so, you know, there are people in Ukraine who aren't Ukrainian, right? And so this, you know, creates some of these problems. I guess, yeah. So that. Andre Pruby, that's the one other person I want to mention. So after the government from, I think, 2016 to 2019, this guy, Andre Pruby, who gets in close with the West, he travels to the United States and things like that, is a member of the Svoboda Party of Ukraine. And they initially, when the party was founded in the 1990s, openly embraced like Nazi like ideas and insignias and logans, you know, and slogans and all that kind of stuff, right? Now, in the 2000s, I think they had like a new main party member come in, and you know, he really advocated changing some of this stuff. And so now, if you look at their like logos and things like that, it's like a big peace, like yellow peace symbol with a blue background. But you know, they made it very clear during that transition, it's not about ideology per se, is just about, you know, branding and things like that. Similar to in Syria, when the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq told the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria to change your name, you know, from Al-Qaeda in Syria to Al-Nusra, that way the Americans will give you more weapons, right? You know, you change your branding a little bit and the Americans, you know, will fall in love with you. It's not that hard to fool them or, you know, get them not to care. And so in 2016, there's a good article by James Carden in The Nation where he outlines how the Obama's Pentagon lobbied Congress to take a provision out of the 2016 NDAA. I'm pretty sure it was put there by Tulsi Gabbard, but I'm not positive about that. But that provision was the like Stop Army Nazis Act or something like that, or a specific thing that would bar weapons being sent to groups with like far right ideological extremists, like, you know, and for real, not like, you know, the local guy down the street that likes to hang a Confederate flag, but, you know, the guys that will go out and kill people in Ukraine and things like that based on their, you know, ethnic status and things. And so, so anyways, the Pentagon had Congress take that out of the bill. Right. Like, well, what more telling sign that do you need? You also, and you know, I don't love the UN. I'm not preaching international government. You know, there's certainly other reasons than, you know, opposing Nazis to like oppose the UN adopting different mandates and things. But there was a vote in the UN on like condemning army Nazis in every country but Ukraine and the United States voted for it, or those were the only two countries that voted against it. I think there are some abstentions. And so that's based on what's happening in Ukraine. Further, the New Zealand Christchurch shooter, you know, they banned his manifesto and everything, but in his manifesto, there are references to Ukraine and his desires to travel to Ukraine. There's a former soldier in the United States who committed some pretty violent crimes after traveling to Ukraine. You could watch an episode of Trap It on Nat Geo that details the white supremacist ties in Eastern Ukraine and how the U.S. has been involved in that. And in fact, Newsweek wrote an article on this, and former Obama administration official Evelyn Farkas said, yeah, they're Nazis, but when Russia's going to invade, you arm and back who you have to back. And so this is this is like, you know, real stuff that we're dealing with here, actual neo-Nazi presence in Ukraine.
Is that a dog or is there a woman in your basement?
No, that's I got a little husky here who is not happy that he's not getting attention right now. But yeah, I'll get him to be a little bit more quiet.
I was just making sure. I go, is there a coffee cup moving along, making that sound or something? So on February 21st, Putin says, in March of 2021, Ukraine adopted a new military strategy based on the belief that this document he's referring to is almost completely aimed at confrontation with Russia. They want to drag foreign states into the conflict with our country. The strategy suggests organizing Russian Crimea and Donbass as basically terrorist undergrounds, and it also outlines the possible war. Are you familiar with any document like this?
I don't know about the document. I mean, again, you know, going back to all this, you know, there is a war being waged here and everything. One important detail in the recent fighting that's broken out in Ukraine is that in the like couple days leading up to Putin declaring, the independence of the Donbass region and then giving this speech, there was like 5,000 something reports of like artillery fire along the line of control, an outbreak of fighting in the Ukrainian civil war between the people of the Donbass and the Ukrainian army, including the National Guard, which includes the Azov Battalion, right? But during that fighting, they said that like 80% are like the vast majority of the ceasefire violations were committed by the side of the Ukrainian army. And so, not that that justifies what Putin is doing here, but it is, kind of important to note that, this fighting has been going on a long time and a lot of people are, being killed who are on the Russian bad side of this.
So it's really clear if you read the work of Pat Buchanan in 1999, he says, bringing Latvia, Lithuania, and some have even urged Ukraine into NATO will be a direct threat to Russia, just as the Soviets putting missiles in Cuba was never going to be allowed by the Americans. What do you see NATO expansion as the primary cause behind Putin invading?
I think so. I think that is the primary cause. I think that things going on internally in Ukraine are very important to Putin as well. Like, what we're talking about here with the fighting going on in eastern Ukraine and the Nazi elements in the government and that government's alignment with the West and everything like that. However, I think a lot of the most important stuff going on here is about the NATO expansion because of what NATO expansion means. And so at the end of the Cold War, there are only 14 countries in NATO. Now there's 16. It's a pretty significant increase. At the end, that it was West Germany, the U.S. reunited Germany, and then, made Germany a NATO member. Then it included Poland, which, of course, the Warsaw Pact was the Russian counter to NATO, and now Warsaw is a NATO member. That's, these are pretty crazy things. But then the Baltic states, which border Russia and right near the area with St. Petersburg, is very significant and important. And so, these are real security threats. But in 2008, George Bush really stepped on the Russian red line by saying that they were going to put both Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. And so this led to a conflict in Georgia in 2008, where Russia ends up recognizing the independence of South Ossetia and putting a bunch of their troops there to, cement the independence there. And, I guess in a lot of ways, it's just, adds to somewhat of a Russian, proxy little province there. Somewhat like if the, Russia just takes the Donbass, it would probably act in somewhat of that same fashion on that same border. But with NATO membership, it comes not only a guarantee that, if you're attacked, Russia will fight back. And so, if we're talking about adding Ukraine as a NATO member and a skirmish breaks out on the border and the Western countries, interpret that that's an attack by Russia, even if it was an attack by Ukraine or something like that, it could start a war with NATO. NATO insists that it's a defensive alliance and Russia should feel it has nothing to worry about. However, NATO has only fought 3 offensive wars and 0 defensive wars. It fought in Kosovo, Afghanistan, and Libya. And so, you tell me if Russia should just take NATO's word for it that it has no concerns, interest in Russia. I mean, you have for years had like serious U.S. pundits suggesting that there should be regime change in Moscow and things like that. There was a pretty good episode of the Scott Horton Show recently with Lyle Goldstein on all this. And he points out that another significant factor was in just a couple months ago, the U.S. tried to remove the government in Belarus, or at least that's the Russian interpretation of it. I'm not sure how much of the color-coded revolution backed by the U.S. It was, but the U.S. does have a lot of NGOs operating in Belarus that were heavily involved in what was going on there. So, even if the U.S. maybe wasn't directing all the traffic, they certainly laid a lot of the foundation and groundwork. And it's pretty understandable why I think Russia wouldn't interpret what happened in Belarus with the recent protests that way. Yeah, but another big thing with NATO membership is going to come weapons, and a lot of them. You get priority access to weapons, and if we look at what's happened with NATO expansion, it's also been a slow creep of weapons across Europe as well, right? We're deploying more and more troops further east all the time. We're conducting more war games further and further east. It was just a month ago that the UK, I want to say, France and Estonia were carrying out war games right on, like, literally 60 miles from the Russian border. It would take war games 60 miles from the Russian border. Like, you don't think that's be a little bit of an issue if Russia and Canada were carrying out joint tank war games, like, 60 miles from the border with New York? Like, people wouldn't feel a little bit uncomfortable with that? I really think they would. And then, of course, more importantly, things like missiles and particularly the Patriot missile systems, which the U.S. says are defensive. However, the problem is the same tube that you put one of the Patriot missile interceptors in, you can also drop a Tomahawk missile in there, and you can also put a nuclear warhead on a Tomahawk missile. And so I think Russia is concerned, and rightfully so, because the U.S. has already installed these systems in Poland and Romania, that could possibly come to Moscow. And again, looking at maybe an example from the U.S. side, if Russia was talking about putting systems in Cuba today that could hold like their hypersonic cruise missiles or something, I don't think there's any way the U.S. would allow that, and rightfully understand it as a security threat.
Was it Ukraine that Bush wanted to bring into NATO, or Albania and Croatia?
I got to look at a map because there's been like several rounds of NATO expansion. But he wanted to bring Ukraine and Georgia in. That was right at the end of his administration in 2008 that he put Ukraine, Georgia, and maybe also Moldova on that list. I'm not exactly sure about Moldova, but I know that there's been talk about that. But yeah, they've again expanded all the way from Germany to, the borders of Ukraine. People keep talking about on like Fox News and stuff, they're like, well, if Putin takes over Ukraine, then he's going to have more NATO countries on his border, which he doesn't want. And it's like, yeah, but the border he's concerned about is like how far NATO is from Moscow, right? Not necessarily, where the official like line of Russia begins versus the official line of NATO, I think, strategically where his country is. And also you have to remember that, World War II, Germany invaded Russia, well, the USSR, but they did that through Ukraine, and 27 million Russians died fighting there. And so these are everybody's grandparents in Russia, right? Like that's that generation for a lot of these people that fought in World War II, or, didn't even have to fight because the war was in Russia. It's not like America where the only people who really remember World War II are the people who went to combat and in theater, right? Like my grandpa didn't even really talk much about it because he was just stationed in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. Like, I don't think he really did much up there other than be cold. Where, like the people who went to Europe and in the Philippines, but that is still only a few Americans when it was the Russians, right? Like they fought, like the people fought a war against Germany to stop the Nazis from taking Moscow. Like that almost happened. And so now you've had in the past 30 years, America reestablished Germany as one country after it was divided in World War II, in part because of, the crimes of Germany during World War II and how everything worked out. But, we've now reunited Germany, made it an integral part of the NATO alliance, is one of the biggest economies in NATO now. And that, alliance has absorbed more and more countries and is getting closer and closer to Russia's border.
In Putin's February 24th speech, he actually gives the outline of the National Socialist invasion of the Soviets. He says, basically, we sat back, we didn't think it could happen. There was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, so we weren't necessarily expecting a war. I don't believe half of this, but that is how a lot of Russians will be able to easily see it. As we sat back and did nothing while the National Socialists were expanding, today it's they sit back and do nothing while NATO's expanding. And he says, As a result, the country was not prepared to counter the invasion by Nazi Germany, which attacked our motherland on June 22, 1941, without declaring war. The country stopped the enemy and went on to defeat it, but it came at a tremendous cost. The attempt to appease the aggressor ahead of the Great Patriotic War proved to be a mistake, which came at a high cost for our people. In the first months after hostilities broke out, we lost vast territories of strategic importance, as well as millions of lives. We will not make that mistake a second time. And it's amazing how similar this is to the Second World War issue, where, look, I mean, as bad as Hitler is it worth staging a world war over the Danzig area, which is where Britain declared war after the Nazis invaded Danzig, a mostly German area. It was like something like 90% German in the Danzig area, because it was Germany previously 20 years ago before the Versailles Treaty. So, I mean, this is what people are risking a world war over. I mean, I'm sorry, please go.
No, I was just going to say, on that point, you know, one thing that happened after World War II is that the West and the UN established the international liberal world order, whatever the post-World II structure of everything that's, you know, quote unquote, kept the peace. And part of that says that you can't change borders anywhere ever, which doesn't make sense because sometimes borders are in the wrong place. And so, you know, this has been basically used to demonize any of America's enemies ever since for, you know, World War II, right? Where you like have Russia, you know, they do a little bit in South Ossetia in Georgia, and that's a huge violation of international world order. Joe Biden is making plans to partition Iraq in like 2009, and that's not a problem at all. So, you know, these are kind of the things that you got going on. Israel's annexation, the creation of South Sudan, an entire new country, the recognition of Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara, the creation of Kosovo, and all these things, right, are all examples of the same thing that Russia did, but it's only bad when Russia does it. The other point I want to make is everybody in the West likes to pretend like, oh boy, we're just going to be Neville Chamberlain and Putin is Hitler and we're going to appease him until it's too late. When, you know, if you look at it, I think Putin has a much stronger case to make that he's been Neville Chamberlain and making appeasement, and that it's his country that has put itself in a security detriment in an effort to prevent any kind of major outbreak of conflict.
I mean, could you imagine, after all we heard for years about Putin and Russia are basically determining American elections, and they're controlling the president of America, and it was all these vagaries. But when it comes to the coup in 2014 in Ukraine, you have John McCain, the presidential candidate, on the ground in Ukraine making speeches in support of overthrowing that government. I mean, with all this election interference, it's so clear that the U.S. wanted all the benefits of having Ukraine on their side without having to bear the cost, because to have them as a NATO member, I mean, I think Zelensky asked in, what was it? Zelensky made it clear in, I'm losing the date on this, June 14th, 2021, Zelensky says, of course we'd like to become a member of NATO. It's stipulated in Ukraine's constitution. So it'd be a big liability for them to be explicitly part of it, but still they have a coup in which they're cheering on. I mean, it's like Putin's besties supporting a coup in Canada. And then, I mean, it's just so unbelievable that they're playing. I can't think of a better example than Russian roulette is just coming to mind. But it's like they're playing Russian roulette with millions of lives here over this border dispute in the freaking Donbass. Any final thoughts on the Donbass and what's going on there, and maybe giving us a better idea of where this Donbass versus Ukrainian government thing came from and where it's going?
Oh man, there's a lot there. So I think the NATO membership is like probably the most important thing, right? That's probably Putin's strongest red line here. I think he would really like to have the missile defense systems out of Poland and Romania, but the NATO membership was huge. Now, the most important thing for everybody to know is Ukraine was never going to become a NATO member state. For a country to become a NATO member state, it has to get the approval of every other NATO member state. And it doesn't matter how trivial another country's objections are, they could block any other state from joining. For example, Greece blocked North Macedonia from joining NATO until they changed their name to make it more clear that their name didn't suggest that they could have any potential future claim to the Greek Republic, like state Republic of Macedonia, right? Like that's the level that, you know, we're talking about, that you could like raise an objection to block another country from joining. And so Germany and France have made it very clear from the start that they really don't want Ukraine in NATO. Hell, even the Ukrainian people don't really pull all that in favor of NATO. And so so that's a real important point too. There are standards that a country has to make. It actually has to be a democracy, and Ukraine really isn't. In part because a huge portion of the country lives in areas that the Ukrainian government claims, but they don't control. And so those people don't vote at all. You just also have like the fact that a major party in Ukraine is the Sloboda Party and, you know, has Nazi ideology. Like that's going to be an issue for some NATO member states. And then the corruption problem. They don't meet any of the corruption needs and reforms, and they're nowhere near a path to. And so even, you know, if Ukraine was really all they wanted to do is join NATO and were really trying to do like reforms and get there, I think it would still be like a decade. And Joe Biden has made that point clear, that Ukraine is not joining NATO anytime in the next decade. However, rather than just taking NATO membership off the table for Ukraine because it's never going to be a NATO state, because I think the fundamental issue is that NATO countries understand that Article 5 of the NATO treaty says that if one member is attacked, all members are attacked and you respond. I think there's going to be NATO member states like particularly France and Germany, which have large armies, like some of these really small states might not really object just because they can't really contribute anything to the fight anyways, like Montenegro. But, Germany and France will be called to, and they will lose a significant amount of troops fighting for Ukraine. And they just don't want to do that. And so they would never allow them into NATO, right? So rather than just making that explicitly clear that, you know, NATO is North Atlantic and Asia is pretty far from the Atlantic. And so, you know, that is where we're talking. We're almost in Asia we're talking about here with Ukraine. And with Georgia, we are. And to just say that, no, we're not going to have these countries in NATO, and just would have probably prevented this invasion from happening. And so the Ukrainian government doubled down on that in January after one of their diplomats, I think maybe it was a UK official, had met with the Ukrainian official, then said, maybe they're willing to wiggle on this. And they said, no, you know, we still really want to join NATO. Now, the bigger problem is, I think the Biden administration really started to treat Ukraine as a de facto NATO member. They constantly, every day, there's somebody in the Biden administration saying, we are committed to Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty. What does that sound like to you, Keith? That sounds like to me that if somebody invades Ukraine, the U.S. is going to try to stop them. So that kind of sounds like what happens when a country is a NATO member. So, you know, kind of making them de facto NATO members. Also, the U.S. really has ramped up in the past few years its deployment of weapon systems to Ukraine, including Turkey giving Ukraine their TB2 armed drones, which have been significant on battlefields in Nagorno-Karabakh and Tigray, Ethiopia. And so, you know, these are significant weapon systems, right, to give armed drones to a country that operate fairly well. The U.S. has been giving them Javelin missiles, which are fairly advanced anti-armor. Different NATO countries have been pouring in shoulder-fired missiles. I think the Poles are giving them Grons, and everybody else is giving them Stingers. Artillery systems from Germany and Norway. More and more weapons flooding into Ukraine. Ukraine was trying to get the Iron Dome system from Israel, according to Israeli sources. You know, this is what happens when you're a NATO member state. Oh, the Florida National Guard was in Ukraine training the Ukrainian soldiers, right? The U.S. has a intelligence operation with the CIA where they're hiring paramilitaries to train Ukrainian soldiers on, you know, insurgency tactics and things like this. This is a CIA ground branch. It's reported in Yahoo News. You know, just out there, you know, they're talking about that these are going to be the people that lead the insurgency against Russia. And this is probably where I'll get to my final thought here, which is, you know, I don't know how much the Biden administration provoked this, but I do think they saw an opportunity here and willfully chose not to negotiate, to exercise or to more likely lead to the thing that they would get to exercise the opportunity in the light of a Russian invasion to basically turn Ukraine into the next Afghanistan. And the most disgusting part about this, of course, is that everybody's got, like, Jen Rubin has the Ukrainian flag in her bio and things like that. But they are sacrificing Ukraine on the altar of NATO, right? They are fighting the Russians to the last Ukrainian to deal a blow to Putin because they want dead Russian soldiers. It's very clear. If you watch anybody in the media, anytime they talk about Russian soldiers being killed, they're talking about it with glee, right? And in a sense, like, you know, they are an invading army and things like that. But at the same time, like, this is what they want, right? This is the point. And it doesn't matter how many Ukrainians die. Even Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, not that long ago, was saying that, look, this is going to be terrible for the Ukrainians, but it's going to be a loss for Russia too. And so I think that's a lot of the thinking here. You got Victoria Nuland in the administration. You got, my friend, the host of the Around the Empire podcast, Joanne Leone, showed me this clip of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former national security advisor and, you know, a leading foreign policy establishment thought leader in the United States, right? Like, he has acolytes who are in the Biden administration and things like that. He's talking about how great it would be to have Russia engaged in street-by-street fighting in Ukraine, right? That this is going to be something that really deals a blow to the Ukrainian army. This is crazy stuff that we're talking about here. And I'm not saying that I know for sure that's what happened, but I have a very strong suspicion that the Biden administration was at least more willing to allow this conflict to happen because at least parts of the administration thought it would be a good thing for America to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. And that's the really disgusting policy that we're talking about here.
Well, even people like Gideon Rose, who was the, I think he was the senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, publication mm-hmm. of the Council on Foreign Relations, explicitly, like in this funny way, is like, Ukraine is Putin's girlfriend and we're trying to steal his girlfriend away. As though, like, millions of lives aren't at stake over the territorial integrity of countries with regard to NATO expansion. I mean, is it correct that they never invoked Article 5 until 2001? Because that was the research that I found. I don't think they ever did until.
I don't think so. Because I don't think they invoked Article 5 for the actions in Kosovo or Libya, but they were NATO-sponsored actions.
Well, I mean, if you just that almost tells you everything you need to know. The hubris and lack of humility. They spent 20 years to give Afghanistan to the Taliban after 11 days, and now they want to take on nuclear Russia, who, I mean, it certainly looks like they have a positive relationship with China when it comes to Putin and Xi meeting. So what, we're going to take on Russia, Iran, and China over the Donbass region of Ukraine after we just lost to Afghanistan? Absolutely sickening stuff.
So just real quick on this point, though, I'm watching Fox News, right, because they do have a guy in Kiev who at least is giving some updates and things like that. But they have on some guest, and the guest is saying that, and you know who was there for America after 9/11? And I get all excited. I get a big grin on my face because I know that the first world leader to call George Bush after 9/11 was Vladimir Putin. And he said, whatever you need, like, to facilitate, like, the invasion of Afghanistan, like, he offered up old Soviet bases in Central Asia, supply lines and things like that. And he goes, NATO was there for America.
Oh, my God.
And that's
why
he said, span NATO to Ukraine. And what does Ukraine have to do with Afghanistan, right? Like, if that's the example that you're using, like, how, and that's just, like, one example of how ahistorical all the media coverage has been on all of this. It's just, like, no concept of what has happened in recent history over the past, you know, 30 years or, you know, longer than that even. Like, the fact that the last time they provoked I guess they were calling Afghanistan the Soviets Vietnam back then, but over a million Afghans died. So do you really want to do that to Ukraine?
Just finishing off with a quote from Frederick the Great, which feels belittling calling him Frederick the Great, but you get what I'm saying. He who wants to defend everything defends nothing, and he who wants to be everyone's friend has no friends in the end. Thank you for watching, Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Kyle Anzalone, thank you for your time, brother.
Thank you, Keith.